This is Stuart Allen speaking from the Chapel of the Open Book, Wilson Street, London. Today we are continuing our study in the prophecy of Jeremiah. Now last time we tried to get the historical background of this great prophecy. It was very essential because unless we see the background in which Jeremiah lived, we shall never appreciate what this man's life and what his service and what his witness had to be and what it cost him. He started off his ministry in the time of the last great reforming king of Judah, Josiah. And he ministered right on to the end of the kings of Israel and Judah until Nebuchadnezzar was permitted by God to come and break down the city walls, Jerusalem, smash the temple to bits, take the sacred vessels that Solomon had provided to his own temple in Babylon, and to take the princes and a lot of the people captive. Now that was a very sore punishment indeed. But God had held it back for centuries. He'd warned and warned and warned what he would have to do if this people persisted in their idolatry. And Israel just didn't hear. We said before, what a lamentable time for study the period of Israel's kings is. Over and over and over again do we read, he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. And if you get evil leaders, well, you're not going to get a responsive people to the truth. There were bad leaders, and the people, of course, slipped right away from God. God was a long-suffering God, or he held back that judgment for so long. And at last, to Jeremiah, he revealed what he was going to do. For it is in Jeremiah's prophecy that we first have the inkling that God is going to use a heathen nation, Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon, to chastise this people for 70 years. Now you can see what a difficult position Jeremiah was in, because he was a great patriot. It's quite obvious from his writing. He loved his people, and yet he had to do something that he hated. Practically all his ministry is condemnation and judgment. So he knew quite well he was never going to be popular. He had to tell this people that Nebuchadnezzar was coming and God was going to permit him to come and destroy their city and take them captive. Of course, he ran the risk of being called a traitor, and he was called that. Just imagine in a time when Nebuchadnezzar was on the threshold, having to tell that people to submit to the enemy and to give in and not fight. That's what he had to do. Why he was looked on as a saboteur and a traitor, you could just imagine the position he was in. And so you see, being a man of intense feelings, he was torn between these conflicting emotions. That is to say, loyalty to his people, but first of all, loyalty to his God. And the unpopular message which God had given him to proclaim. Now last time I pointed out that the personality of Jeremiah shines through his prophecy clearer than any other Old Testament prophet. And for this reason, that every so often the narrative is interrupted by some personal statement by Jeremiah, either a prayer or a confession or a very strong outburst of feeling. And there are some 12 of these outbursts, if I may so call them. They are practically that. And I thought tonight we would start off by looking at these because it gives us an insight into the character of this man. So will you turn first of all to the first chapter where we have the prophet's commission and his calling. Verse 4. Then the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee, and before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee, and I ordained thee a prophet unto the nations. Now what was Jeremiah's response to that extraordinary statement by God? Ah, Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I'm a child. The word child doesn't give you quite what he said. He didn't mean to say he was a baby. What he said was, I'm a youth. And as far as we can judge, he was no more than 20 years old at this time. Oh, he's saying, in effect, Lord, don't ask me to do that. I'm inexperienced. I'm only a youth. I'm not able to do that. So, the very beginning, we see his shrinking. And he reminds me, possibly reminds you too, very much of another character in the New Testament, another young man, Timothy. Timothy was a shrinking character. He wasn't a pushful sort of young fellow that pushed himself to the front. No, the apostle had to encourage him, had even on one occasion to say, God hasn't given us the spirit of cowardice, fear. No. Fancy having to say that to the one he loved so dearly. And yet, God had chosen that young fellow to follow that giant for the truth, the apostle Paul. And here, God chose this man. You see, he knew what Jeremiah was like long before he was born. God said so. Before you were born, I knew all about you. I set you apart. I sanctified you. I chose you. We have to say sometimes, doesn't God choose extraordinary people to do his work? He doesn't choose the type of person we would think was most suited. But he doesn't make mistakes. He knows. And so, this man's modesty comes out, and his fear. Oh, I can't speak, Lord. I'm only a youth. And God has to say to him, don't say that. Say not that I am a youth, for thou shalt go to all that I send thee, and whatsoever I command thee, thou shalt speak. And it wasn't going to be a blessing. It wasn't going to be easy. You see, it's not terribly hard for a man to get up and tell people of all the lovely things and the blessing, the wonderful thing that God is going to do for them. That's not terribly hard. And of course, you're popular if you give that sort of message. But Jeremiah, as we've seen, wasn't going to do that. He was going to tell them some hard, difficult things. And he was going to be hated by his own people for telling them the truth. But God said, you go and do that. I've commanded you. And God's biddings, as we know, are God's enablings. And he did enable this man right to the very end. Although he had terrible opposition and persecution, as we shall see. The next we shall find in chapter 4. This is an extraordinary outburst. If you read the first part of the chapter, you'll see part of the terrible warning of judgment that God had given him. He had to tell Jerusalem and publish in the city that judgment was coming, surely, certainly. And then he says in verse 10, suddenly you get this outburst. Then said I, Ah, Lord God, surely thou hast greatly deceived this people and Jerusalem, saying, You shall have peace, whereas the sword reacheth unto the soul. Now you see, he must have felt intensely to talk like that. Fancy accusing God of deceiving the people. Yet, to get quite clear what he meant was this. There were false prophets that made this man's work difficult. Oh, Satan knows, doesn't he, how to bring his servants onto the scene. There were false prophets who deliberately contradicted what Jeremiah said. Jeremiah had warned them this judgment was coming. And he told them the length of time, 70 years. The false prophet said, no, don't listen to him. He's exaggerating. At the very most, it'll be 2 years. You see? And what he's really saying, Lord, why did you allow these false prophets to come and tell lies like that? Why didn't you stop them? Thou hast greatly deceived this people. They were the people that said, you shall have peace, and you shall not have the sword. Well, you can see how wrought he must have been to have spoken like that. Then you come on to chapter 10. Again, in another setting of judgment and condemnation. Verse 20. Behold, the noise of the brook is come. Now here's an example of Old English. This word, of course, comes straight from the French. If you remember anything about your French at school, you remember bruit means noise. But here it means rumour. The noise of the rumour is come, and a great commotion out of the north country, that's referring to Babylon, because Babylon always invaded from the north, to make the cities of Judah desolate, and a den of dragons. And then he breaks in, O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his steps. What he's really saying is this, O Lord, I know that the way of man belongs not to himself. That's to say, he hasn't got complete control over his future. It is not in man that walks to establish or to direct his steps. And then he has to ask the Lord to keep him right. He must be kept right as well as the people. O Lord, correct me. But with judgment, not in thine anger, lest thou bring me to nothing. Pour out thy fury upon the heathen, the nations, that know thee not, and upon the families that call not on thy name. For they have eaten up Jacob, and devoured him, and consumed him, and have made his habitation desolate. He asks God to judge the Gentile nations, and of course he has Babylon largely in mind. Well, presently, in this prophecy, he's going to be given God's judgment against Babylon. Oh, that was coming all right. In fact, God has set him, as chapter 1 tells us, over the nations as well as Israel. And so there are many Gentile nations that this man had to warn against. Babylon was one. Although God was going to allow Babylon to do this thing, he was going to judge her because she exceeded far, went far in advance than what God ever said. And so we find at the end in chapters 50 and 51, God's judgment through this man's ministry on Babylon. So God was going to do that, but you'll notice he doesn't say here, pour out thy fury upon Judah or Israel. Pour it out upon the Gentile nations, the heathen, as the word is always translated, or very often is translated, in the Old Testament. Chapter 11. Verse 18. Chapter 11. And verse 18. And the Lord hath given me knowledge of it, and I know it. Then thou showest me their doing. Now, if you look at the context, which we can't read fully because of time, you will see now he's dealing with those who were conspiring against him. The false ones, his enemies. They were trying to overthrow him. They were trying to catch him, you see. And he said, I was like a lamb, or an ox that is brought to the slaughter. And I knew not that they had devised devices against me, saying, let us destroy the tree with the fruit thereof, and let us cut him off from the land of the living, that his name may be no more remembered. Oh, they hated him already because of the message he'd given, you see. Well, let's do away with him. And then he cries out, but, O Lord of hosts, that judgeth righteously, that tries the reins and the heart. You may know that in the original Hebrew, the word reins is the word kidneys. Very extraordinary figure. God tries the kidneys because the Old Testament and the ancient people thought that the kidneys were the seat of the emotions. That's why. And while we laugh at that, we say, well, that's very primitive, but you know, we use similar figures. You know quite well that at a time of stress, you get a peculiar feeling down here in your abdomen very often. You see? And you could be pardoned for thinking that that was the seat of your feelings or emotions. It isn't. Of course, it's a reflex from the actual, from the brain. But there it is. But here is the one who tests, who knows the thoughts and the intentions of the heart. Oh, it's good to remember that, isn't it? And because God does do that, he has the ability to do that. You see, that's why he can be the righteous judge. That's it. For he's not only looking at men's actions, the outside, he's looking at men inside first. For God looketh not at the outward appearance, said Samuel. God looketh at the heart. He knows a man's thoughts. He knows a man's intentions. He knows sometimes those thoughts and intentions well-meaning and good, but they don't come out into actions. And you know, sometimes the actions don't accurately reflect what's gone on in the thoughts. Very much like the apostle was going to describe centuries later in Romans 7, when he spoke of that conflict. He did the things that I don't want to do, I find myself doing. And the things that I ought to do, I don't do. You see? His actions didn't always truly reflect what was going on inside. Well, no human being can righteously judge a man like that. But God can. God can. He knows all the thoughts and the intentions of the heart. Jeremiah knew that. You're the one that judges righteously, Lord. You test. You know the reins in the heart, the thinking. Let me see thy vengeance on them, for unto thee have I revealed my cause. You must remember, we're not yet in the age of grace. We're not yet in the age of the one who said, love your enemies, do good to them that hate you. You're still under the covenant of law, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. So when you read some of these Old Testament books, don't be shocked, because some of these Old Testament saints ask God to take vengeance on their enemies. This is where we have to rightly divide the word of truth and keep things in their proper setting. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of the men of Anathoth that seek thy life, saying, prophesy not in the name of the Lord, that thou die not by our hand. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will punish them. Yes. God assured him that he was going to punish and protect his servant, punish the enemies, and look after the one that he had chosen. Now, let's look at chapter 12. Chapter 12 is really a continuation of this. He goes on with his prayer, righteous art thou, O Lord, when I plead with thee, yet let me talk with thee of thy judgments. And then comes this problem which so many of the Old Testament saints had to face. Why the wicked prosper? It's still a problem, isn't it? Let's face it. We don't know the complete answer. Wherefore doth the way of the wicked prosper? That was Asaph's trouble. He couldn't understand why it was that those who sought to live as God would have them live righteously, seemed to have all the troubles, and those that ignored the Lord and went their own way and just sinned as much as they wanted to, they seemed to have everything. Their souls were fat, they prospered in their business, they seemed to come, they're not in trouble like other men, said Asaph. Everything goes right with them. And with the child of God, everything seems to go wrong. Habakkuk had the same problem. He just couldn't understand how a holy God could have anything to do with sinful men or use them at all. And it was over this same nation, Babylon. If you look at Habakkuk, God had said to that man, I'm going to raise up these Chaldeans, this awful nation. I'm going to use them as a judgment against my people. And then the reply of the prophet was this, thou art of purer eyes than to behold iniquity. You can't even look on it, Lord. Well, how can you use such people as the Chaldeans? That was this man's problem, do you see? And that is a problem, let's face it. And God does. And he is able to use it. Not that he originates sin. Oh no, we mustn't ever talk about God being the author of sin, but he can make all things work together for good. That's the evil as well as the good. Oh yes, he can. He can overrule the evil so that it finally turns out to his praise and to his glory. Oh, we can be terribly thankful that he does do that. And he is the wonder-working God. But here's this man then with his same problem asking him, why the way of the wicked prospers? And then he turns to himself, verse 3, but thou, O Lord, knowest me. Thou hast seen me. Thou hast tried my heart toward thee. Yes. And God knew that his servant was at his very heart determined to be faithful whatever it costs. But, verse 4, how long shall the land mourn? He has to cry. The herbs of every field wither for the wickedness of them that dwell therein. Many times God, you see, literally judged them by withholding blessing from the land, so that they had no fruits, the vines didn't prosper, they had no corn, the animals suffered and died, and so on. It was literal judgment in that sense, apart from any spiritual judgment. For the wickedness of them that dwell therein, the beasts are consumed, and the birds, because they said, he shall not see our last end. They thought they were dealing with a God who didn't see and didn't know and took no account. But oh, alas, they had to learn that God's long suffering wasn't because he didn't see and didn't know what was going on and didn't care. It was because he cared so much that he finally had to intervene. Chapter 14. Verse 7. O Lord, though our iniquities testify against us, do thou it for thy name's sake. For our backslidings are many. We have sinned against thee. Note, he doesn't try and justify himself or his nation. Now that's, of course, a thing that I think we must learn too. It's no good for us to put any pose of self-righteousness when we're dealing with the Lord. Not a bit. He knows us just as we are, and it's no good us trying to put a good face on everything to him, because he sees through all that facade. It's far better for us to just go before him and say, well, Lord, you know all about me. Sins, failings, everything. Good points, if any, yes, you know those as well. That's what this man did. He said, you know. And then he falls back on the faithful name of God. Many of the Old Testament saints did that. They reminded the Lord of his name, the covenant-keeping God, Jehovah. That was all they could do. They couldn't bring anything, any righteousness of their own before the Lord. They said, well, Lord, remember your covenant. Remember what you promised Abraham. Remember your name. And the Lord likes that, you know, to be reminded of his promises and his covenants. You won't offend God by reminding him of his word. No, we can do that often. So he said in verse 8, oh, the hope of Israel. He's called that at least twice in this prophecy, the hope of Israel. And so he is, Israel's only hope. Do you remember how right in the New Testament, at the end of the book of the Acts, we find the Apostle Paul bound for the hope of Israel? Yes. The dominating thought of the New Testament, right to the end of the Acts of the Apostles, is Israel and the possibility of Israel's hope being realized. The Saviour, not only the hope, verse 8, thereof in time of trouble, why shouldest thou be as a stranger in the land? And as a wayfaring man that turneth aside to tarry for a night, and so on. You find him reminding the Lord of his graciousness and his goodness. Well, that's all, of course, one can do. Read down sometime to the end of verse 21. As to say in verse 19, hast thou utterly rejected Judah? Hath thy soul loathed Zion? Why hast thou smitten us, and there is no healing for us? We look for peace, and there is no good, and for the time of healing, and behold, trouble. So one minute, you see, he's asking the Lord to be the merciful God to this people, and then realizing, of course, as he looked upon them, all their animosity towards himself, their animosity towards God, their sin and their declension, he's forced to ask God to punish them, and to bring them back again. That's the only way that they will be brought back to himself by this rod of correction. Chapter 17. Again, you get this title, the hope of Israel. Verse 13. O Lord, the hope of Israel, all that forsake thee shall be ashamed, and they that depart from thee shall be written in the earth, because they have forsaken the Lord, the fountain, the origin of living waters. Heal me, O Lord, and I shall be healed. Save me, and I shall be saved, for thou art my praise. Behold, they say to me, where is the word of the Lord? Let it come now. Wasn't that like the psalmist? Where is now their God, says the psalmist, that my enemies say to me. They were taunting him, you see. But it just threw this man back upon the Lord and upon his strength and upon his graciousness. So there's another little outburst from Jeremiah, chapter 18. He's dealing again with his personal enemies. Verse 18, let us pick it up. Then said they, come, let us devise devices against Jeremiah. For the law shall not perish from the priest, nor counsel from the wise, nor the word from the prophet. Come, let us smite him with a tongue. Let us not give heed to any of his words. You note that it's a rather extraordinary figure of speech, to smite with the tongue. It's a good example of a figure of speech, because when you can't take a phrase literally, you know a figure is being used. You can't hit anybody with your tongue. At least I can't imagine anybody that can do it. It had to be a very long one to do that. But the tongue, of course, is put by what we call metonymy for the words that it utters. That's it. Let us smite Jeremiah with these words of animosity. And then in verse 19, give heed to me, O Lord. Hearken, listen to the voice of them that contend with me. And so on. And then he has some awful things to say. Christians that read these verses might say, well, this man hasn't got a very Christian spirit. But again, I say to you what I pointed out just now. He's not living in a Christian dispensation. He's living under the age of law, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. That's all this man could know. The dispensation of grace that is your lot, oh, how favoured we are, and my lot to live in, Jeremiah yet knew nothing about. That was yet to come. Chapter 20. Again he has to say, concerning... There was a one called Pasha who had upset him, who had actually in verse 2 he'd smitten him, hit him, and put him in the stocks, Jeremiah. So you see what this man had to go through. He was thrown in prison, he was let down into a dungeon and let down into the mud, and had to be pulled out, half dead. He was put in the stocks and ridiculed. He was punched and hit. Oh, doesn't it remind you something of the sufferings of what Paul had to go through for Christ, that he lists in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. All these Old Testament saints and the New Testament saints, what they had to endure for their Saviour's sake. And we've had to endure so little, have we not? Let's be honest. And yet they went through it by God's grace and by God's strength. And Paul could write and say, in spite of all the persecutions, he wrote to Timothy, yet out of them all, the Lord delivered me. What a testimony. And so shall we be able to say that, I'm sure, as we trust him. Out of them all, the Lord delivered me. Now, verse 7, after dealing with this enemy, he cries to the Lord, O Lord, thou hast deceived me, and I was deceived. Now here's this extraordinary statement again. Before he accused God of deceiving the people. Now he said, you've deceived me. Thou art stronger than I. Thou hast prevailed, I am in derision daily. Everyone mocks me. You can see what this man was going through, can't you? You can see how upset he was. I want to point out, just to be quite faithful, that the word deceive used here is not the same one as you had in the previous chapter. It is sometimes translated to persuade. To strongly persuade or induce. Thou hast persuaded me, might be true. But even if someone says to me, no, I think it means deceived, well, then we can say that if that is so, this man's feelings are still intense. He's still torn between these conflicting emotions that must have gone on all the time towards the Lord, who'd called him to this most difficult and dangerous task, because he went many times with his life in his hands, and the love for his people. He wanted to see this judgment averted, if possible. And so you find this man one minute almost saying to the Lord, well, you've deceived me and you've deceived the people. And the next minute he's reminding the Lord that he's the faithful, covenant-keeping God. You see how human he is. Isn't it good to realise that these Old Testament saints and the New Testament ones were men of like passions as we are? That's what James says concerning Elijah. What a monumental character Elijah was, standing practically alone in the day of apostasy. Ahab, Jezebel, just think of those monsters of iniquity reigning and ruling. And this man stands against them and stands against all the prophets of Baal. That magnificent scene on Mount Carmel, you remember, one of the highlights of the Old Testament. And yet, within a very short time after, the same man is saying to God, Lord, take away my life. I'm no better than my fathers. In the depths of despair and depression, 1 minute standing out firmly for the Lord, the next minute asking God to take away his life. But what do you say when you read about people like that? Do you say they're weak or they're changeable? No, no. They're very human, though. They're very human. And so if sometimes you in your own heart and mind feel something like this, well, remember, others have trod that pathway too. Some of the great saints of God have done that. But the same Lord that enabled them is the same Lord that enabled us. They change and we change, but he never. I, the Lord, change not. The God who's the same, the Christ who's the same yesterday and today and forever. And so you want to read on the whole way through from verse 7, this is a long passage, right to the end of the chapter. But you'll notice one thing, so depressed is he that 1 minute he's praising the Lord and the next minute he's cursing the day he was born. Have you seen that? Look at verse 12. But, O Lord of hosts that triest the righteous and seest the reins and the heart, we've got the same figure again, let me see thy vengeance on them. For unto thee have I opened my cause. Sing unto the Lord, praise ye the Lord, for he hath delivered the soul of the poor from the hand of evildoers. Then he goes on the next verse, cursed be the day wherewith I was born. Let not the day wherein my mother bare me be blessed. Cursed be the man who brought tidings to my father, saying, a man child is born unto thee, making him very glad. Look at the extremities. 1 minute praising the Lord, the next minute saying like Job, cursing the day he was born. Well, you see, all this is giving us an insight into this man's makeup. And you see, the Bible doesn't whitewash the people of God. Oh no. You see him just like, you remember Oliver Cromwell, when he had his portrait painted, he told the man who was painting the portrait to put in the warts and all. Yes. And so you find in the Bible, the warts are there. All the failings are there, but at the same time, the virtues, the God-given virtues, are there too, so that we can get a balance over these things. And the last one you'll find in chapter 32, and this gives a wonderful history of God's dealing with this people. It sounds very much like other passages in the Old Testament. Very much like some of the speeches of Moses when you read it. Verse 17. Our Lord God, behold, thou hast made the heaven and the earth by thy great power and a stretched out arm, and there is nothing too hard for thee. Is anything too hard for the Lord? Remember that? God had to say that once to somebody. And the word hard, you know, in the original means wonderful. It's the same word that is used in Isaiah of one of the names of Christ. The child that was going to be born, his name shall be called Wonderful. Is anything too wonderful for the Lord? No. You're dealing with the wonder-working God. It's neither too hard nor too wonderful for him to work out, if it's his will. And so, here's the prophet telling us that. Verse 18, thou showest loving kindness unto thousands, and recompensed the iniquity of the fathers into the bosom of the children after them, the great and mighty God, the Lord, Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts, is his name. Great in counsel, mighty in work. For thine eyes are open upon all the ways of the sons of men, to give every one according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings, which hath set signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, going back to the Exodus from the bondage under Pharaoh, even unto this day, and in Israel among other men, and has made thee a name as at this day, and has brought forth the people Israel out of the land of Egypt with signs and with wonders and with a strong hand, with a stretched out arm and with great terror, and has given them this land which thou didst swear to their fathers to give them, a land flowing with milk and honey, using the same expression as Moses. And they came in and possessed it. And then he has to record this: but they obeyed not thy voice, neither walked in thy law. They have done nothing at all that thou commanded them to do. Therefore thou hast caused all this evil to come upon them. What a response was the response of this nation to all the training and the love that God gave through the ministry of his servants. I often marvel as I think on Israel's history recorded in the Old Testament. Time and time again, one of the expressions you get in Jeremiah is this: God speaking of rising up early and sending to them. It occurs several times. God, as though God had rose up early at the very beginning of the day. So keen was he to educate and train and lead his people, rising up early and sending to them. But did that impress Israel? Not in the least. Not in the least. Century after century, generation after generation, they showed the same declension from God, deliberately turning away from him. And then it makes you say sometimes, well, why did God choose such a people? Why did he? Because he knew, of course, exactly what they were going to do in his foreknowledge. Well, I think we have to say this, that if the Lord was going to wait until people were 100% perfect, friends, he wouldn't use anybody. And he's giving this exhibition that all the way through, from the very beginning, ever since the fall, he really has been a God of grace. Even before the dispensation of grace started, you'll still find grace there. The fact that God could use, the fact that God, long-suffering, could hold back all that long time. What grace was there? What mercy? And so you find God exhibiting that over and over again to this unworthy people. Well, he's still the same God. He's still the same God that knows how often you and I fail, because let's face it, we do, you know. He knows that. Does he cast us off? Does he say, well, I'll have them no more? No, he doesn't. He doesn't, because he's a God of infinite grace and mercy. Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him, we're told. He knows our frame. He remembers we are but dust. That's all we are in his sight. Because he knows our weakness and our frame, he's the God of grace and mercy and pity. Well, these shine out so clearly then. This man, a man of contradictions, if you like. So he was. But he was in a terribly difficult situation that intensified these things in his heart and mind. And yet we're going to see that through it all, God wonderfully enabled him, strengthened him, gave him grace, gave him that tenacity to hold fast right to the very end. All his was a checkered career going up and down. And it's all very well for people to talk about a pessimistic Jeremiah. They want to go through what Jeremiah went through. They'd have something to be pessimistic over. Oh no. This man was sorely tried. But isn't it good to have that testimony that he was able to finish the work that God called him to? Yes. And so I believe every child of God that's determined to go the Lord's way, that'll be true of them too. We know it was with the great apostle. He could say at the end, I've finished my course. I've finished. I've finished the work, Lord, you've given me. And I can't think of anything more wonderful if you and I can say that with truth at the end of our earthly course, if we can really say truthfully, Lord, I've finished the work you've given me, I've done it. I haven't given it up, I haven't stopped halfway or three quarters of the way, I've gone all the way. What a grand testimony to be able to give. And in that day, if that is so, we can surely look forward when we stand before him to those words, those glorious words of encouragement and commendation. Well done, good and faithful servant. There's a crown, said the apostle, not for me only. I'm not the only one that will get it, but for all those who have loved his appearing, to all those who kept their eye on that, that's been the great incentive to their work and witness, this glorious appearing. It's been their strength. There's a crown for all such. Not only really living with Christ, but the inexpressible privilege of sharing his reign, reigning with him, sharing that wondrous administration of the universe, when all at last will be gathered under the blessed headship of the Son of God. In the dispensation of the fullness of times, all things in heaven and earth, at last controlled by him, the Lord of all. Well, to think he's willing to share some of that reign with those whom he counts and deems to be faithful. What a joy, what a privilege. Well, let us keep that well in mind, because that will enable us, possibly, to run our course to his glory and to his praise, and perhaps, we hope it may be so, the blessing of others as well through such a testimony.